You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
I always think I know what Romans is about, and then I reread Romans. I don't fault the Reformed for fixating on the formulas that confirm Calvin, and I don't blame Lutherans for taking law as consistently a term of abuse when it seems more fluid to my eyes. But I do wonder at the confidence with which so many read this confounding epistle. How are people so convinced that they know what Romans teaches? And how is it that it doesn't move around every time they reread it when it does every time I do? Today, Christian Humanist Profiles welcomes Dr. Beverly Gaventa to talk about her book, Readings in Romans, Interpreting Paul's Apocalyptic Gospel from Baylor University Press. And perhaps she can tell me either to read more confidently or perhaps to continue in my caution. But either way, we welcome Dr. Gaventa to the show. Beverly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The subtitle of this collection is Interpreting Paul's Apocalyptic Gospel, so we'll start there. What range of things do you mean when you call Paul's gospel apocalyptic? How much does your notion of apocalyptic share with, for instance, John J. Collins' focus on literary conventions? And how much does it share with notions of an age coming to an end, or maybe even the world coming to an end? Take your time here. I have a hunch this is going to inform a lot of our conversation today.
Yeah, that's a good hunch. When we use the word apocalyptic out in the wild, maybe the first thing to say, when we use it out in the wild, sometimes what we mean is just it's a disaster. You know, it's a disaster movie. It's a novel about disaster. It's a climate disaster or something to that effect. That is not what I have in mind, although catastrophe or eucatastrophe in C.S. Lewis's terms might be a good way to think about it. In biblical studies, we tend to use the term in two different ways, and you usually, that's not all that unusual in any field. You usually have to say what you have in mind. Apocalyptic can be, well, apocalypse simply means an uncovering. That's what the word means. It can be used for all sorts of things. In some studies of apocalyptic literature, and you mentioned John Collins, who is one of the primary students of this literature, what you have are certain forms. You have a seer. You have a vision. The following things are going to happen. That's the uncovering of events for the future. And what they mean and why they're going on and so forth. And we have apocalypses in the Bible, the book of Daniel, the book we call the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. Yes. And there are some, there are many apocalypses outside the Bible. When I speak about Romans or any of Paul's letters, Paul's thinking, as being apocalyptic thinking, I'm doing something else altogether. There may be some overlap. Paul speaks about mysteries, Romans 15, and 1 Corinthians 15. And there he comes pretty close to this notion of something that's been revealed about the future. But generally, when people like me talk about apocalyptic thinking and Paul or apocalyptic theology, the focus is on revelation, by which we mean not simply a form, but the content. And what's being revealed often has to do with God's, in the case of Romans, with God's intrusion into the world as it is, which is where it would resemble a little bit this notion of a catastrophic or eucatastrophic event. It is the thing that has happened. Paul talks about the apocalypse of God's power at the present time, right? And that includes a disclosure both of what God has done in Jesus and what that what that event, the incarnation, the death, and the resurrection, what that event means, what it discloses about human life, right? And about, in the case of Romans, about the captivity of human beings to sin and death. We're going to get into a little more of that later on. But I think in Romans, it's important to see that there are, it's more than just God and humans. It's God and other powers in the world that he mostly talks about as sin and death.
Right. Those third parties are definitely important in this kind of a story. Quick follow-up for this. I know that, you know, sometime around the turn of the 20th century, within New Testament studies, and I mean, the name Schweitzer comes to mind, but I didn't prep this, so, you know, I'm going off of 30-year-old memories at this point.
You're doing fine.
Okay, very good. It seems like at that point, you know, people started associating the word apocalyptic with the synoptic gospels at minimum, maybe all four of the gospels. You don't hear it as often when you talk about the Pauline epistles. Is your use of apocalyptic with Paul something that is pretty standard in biblical studies, or are you taking a direction that not a lot of people take?
Well, it's certainly a thread in biblical studies, and you would find it already with Johannes Weiss, with Albert Schweitzer. You find it, and one of the people in theological interpretations of the New Testament, you find it in Barth, in Ernst Casemann, specifically in the post-Second World War period, and it's most prominently associated in the last generation with the work of J. Lewis Martin and J. Christian Becker.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, the best biblical scholarship, I think, gets readers like me to put some original language volumes and some lexica on the table and revisit texts with which we've gotten too familiar. And right out of the gate, readings in Romans does that. So in chapter 1 and elsewhere in Romans, when Paul says that God, quote, handed over the nations to their passions, that's the same verb with which Judas hands over Jesus on Good Friday, and the same verb with which a vanquished general might hand over hostages to a conquering enemy army. So when God is the subject of that verb, when God is the one surrendering, what kind of image is Paul putting in front of us?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I was startled by coming across that myself and realizing, wait a minute, this is the same verb, so what does that mean? I wasn't so much going back to the Gospels, although that's where the language is used. Paul says it himself later on in Romans 8:32 of Jesus. What interested me was looking at the way the word appears both in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and beyond as the handing over. It's not betrayal at that point. It's the surrender to a third party, which connects with what I was saying just a minute ago about the third party. So in short, what I'm saying about the human in chapter one is that because of humanity's unwillingness to recognize that God is God and we are not, God hands humanity over to, in chapter one, he doesn't say what the agent is. He says passions, but I think those are a stand-in for sin and death later on. So that you have, from the beginning, this notion of conflict, not because God has been conquered, in this case, except that God has yielded to human resistance to God and allowed these third parties to rule for the time being.
Right. Now, obviously, we can't get St. Paul on the podcast to interview him. I'd get a ton of downloads if we could. But as best as we can tell, is Paul using that verb that sometimes means surrender to unsettle readers when, you know, we use a verb of God that we usually use for a defeated general? Is that something that, you know, for those first generations of readers, it would have gotten them leaning forward a little bit? Or is that something that was pretty conventional by that point?
That's a great question, and I don't think I could answer it. You know, it's sort of
okay,
above
all right,
my.
That's fair enough.
I don't see. I mean, certainly. Well, it's been a while since I've looked at the details about that. Okay, mm-hmm. But I do think that in the Hebrew Bible, in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, you find God handing over Israel for a period of time. I think
that
in that article, I have some examples of that. So it shouldn't be astonishing, which is not to say that Paul's readers or auditors all had their concordances out and knew every passage.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right? So that's where it gets really murky.
Sure, that makes good sense. Now, another root word that this book gets me rethinking earlier gives us the verb doxane and the verbs doxa and orthodox and paradox. And when I read Plato in English translation, that word gets translated as belief, usually, the counterpart of knowledge. But I never knew that the same word inhabits constructions like doxology, which I associate with praise more than belief or, you know, with opinion, as sometimes it gets translated in a Plato dialogue. So when Paul writes of the glory of the Father or glorifying God in Romans, how much or how little of that lexical flexibility is in play? Is he messing with belief and praise, or is he pretty much talking about praising when he talks about glorifying God?
Yeah, I think to a large extent, when he talks about glorifying God, there is this sort of hard to define combination of praise, gratitude, joy, delight, recognition, mm-hmm. and all of that. But I want to separate out just for a moment, because it's related to what we've been talking about, his mm-hmm. notion of the glory of God. You know, like most people, I think I read right over that. It's just talk about
absolutely.
God, right? Right. As you say, you can read the letter and notice something today that you didn't, you know, notice before. That's what makes this all so vital and instructive. What struck me was that over in 6:4, he says that Jesus was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father.
Right.
And that's what made me think, why is he saying this? Why not just say by the power of the Father or by the Father mm-hmm. or by God?
Right, right.
Right. Why the glory of the Father? And I started looking around, and again, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, in translation, the Septuagint, this doxa tou Theou is the very presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And very often, that presence of God shows up in passages having to do with God's interventions, God's strong actions. I'm trying not to say warfare, but there is some of that. God's,
sure, sure.
God's presence on behalf of God's people, God's determination to have those people over against other forces that might have them. So this notion of Jesus being raised from the dead by the glory of the Father is the strong presence of God himself.
Okay, very good. I want to do another phrase, and I realize I'm doing a lot of translation matters here. Yeah, it's a good commentary to get to think about these kinds of things. So another phrase that, you know, you suggest an alternative translation for is that, you know, when God sends the Son in the likeness of, well, I mean, most translations render it sinful flesh, you say it might be more, it might be good, and I'll let you say why it's good, to translate it instead as the flesh of sin. So, first of all, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, genitive constructions, you can do that. But what might we learn how to see if we render that genitive as the flesh of sin instead of as sinful flesh?
Yeah, that's a great question. The genitive, it's just interesting. When you read in English sinful flesh, you would imagine that what you have there is a noun and an adjective. And that's not, right, as you know, what you have. You have instead a genitive construction. And genitives can do a lot of different things. But one of the things they often do is to display possession, relationship, right? Relationship might be a better way to put it. So instead of saying sinful flesh, which suggests, at least to my ear, that flesh itself is inherently bad, and that's the way people have read Paul for many, 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 many years.
Sure.
And as a teacher, I was the heir often of people who blamed Paul for negative views of their own bodies, right? And
sure.
That's what they had been taught. It wasn't their fault. But if you want to bring out that genitive construction, then it is the flesh that belongs to sin, or the flesh that is under the control, the power of sin. So it isn't flesh itself that's inherently sinful, but that is in the control, under the control of sin.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Now, I want to get to some longer passages now that we've talked about a couple of those brief phrases that, you know, I'm rethinking. And one of those is Romans 3. It's one that is, you know, a segment of Romans that, you know, I felt like I was pretty familiar with. And you taught me to read it as a sort of subversion of the expectations that the book of Psalms would have set up for these readers. So if I can narrate it just a little bit, and you can correct any part of this that you need to. But in a psalm, you often get parallel pairs where, you know, the wicked do this and the wicked do this and the wicked do this, but then the righteous do this and the righteous do this and the righteous do this. And instead of that, Paul says, the wicked do this and the wicked do this and the wicked do this. And boy, aren't we all wicked.
Yeah, that's,
So rhetorically, you know, what is Paul setting up later in the book by subverting what we expect from that sort of psalmic litany?
Yeah, well, let me say a couple of things about that. One is that I never expected to find that pattern in that passage, you know.
Me neither.
I was astonished by it when I started looking at it. And part of what has happened, I think it's a passage, if there's anything in Romans, and there's not much, that people have spent less time with, this is one of those places where what you normally find is, this is a collection of psalm or psalm-like texts that Paul probably inherited from someplace else and he put it in here. And as you say, it is, I mean, to call it pessimistic is a little bit, it's a little bit optimistic. I mean, it's, there's nobody who does anything that's right, right? Their throat is an open grave. I mean, it's a relentless screed about the human being bad. So I started looking up the passages that he uses. And I realized two things. One is what you've already said, which is that by and large in the Psalms, when you get that sort of negative description, you get a contrast, but the righteous do such and such.
Right.
The other thing I started noticing is how much of this is about speech, right? The tongue, the lips, the mouth, it has a certain contemporary resonance that we need not linger over about speech being vile, right? And that interests me. And I started talking with some people who know more about wisdom literature in general, not just the Psalms, but the wisdom literature in general. And when you look at that, those discussions about speech, they're generally the wise person knows how to control her tongue and the foolish person does not, and on and on and on. And you don't get that here either, right?
Right, right.
So I started to take this, as I do, as a powerful lead up to what he's going to say in verses 19 and 20 about how the human mouth is closed. You know, every human mouth has been shut up, and no one is found right before God. Now, if you go back to the passage we talked about at the beginning, 118 and following, you can have the impression there that he's just talking about Gentiles.
Right.
Because the things that he brings up are things Jews often found problematic about Gentiles, particularly their idolatry and their sexual promiscuity, their sexual immorality. So you can think, well, this is just about Gentiles. And then you get into chapter 2, and there's some, I'm just going to put it technically, there's some funny business going on. You know, you've got, well, maybe there are Gentiles who do what's right. Maybe there are Jews who do what's wrong. And he's kind of messed with the categories of Jew and Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
Then he comes back, and in 3:9, he says, all. What we're showing is that all are under sin, right?
Right.
And I think I think this catena, this selection of texts, is a way of powerfully leading his audience finally to see what he's saying. And it's one of a number of places where he may, you know, remember, this is for the ear. He may be prompting them to believe he's about to talk about the good. He's finally going to talk about the righteous. He's going to tell us about people who can control their speech. And no, he's not going to do that either. Because what he's after is what he has said, all are under sin. And that's exactly what he gets to in the rest of the chapter.
Right? Very good. I want to turn to another riff on the Psalms, if I'm allowed to use that phrase. You point to Psalm 119 as a biblical counterpart to Romans 7. Now, Ben Witherington has been on this show to make the case that the persona in Romans 7 is a post-lapsarian Adam rather than a Jesus follower named Paul. But your argument goes in a different and, I would say, you know, subversive direction, claiming that Romans 7 doesn't give us a stable persona, but instead it takes that psalmic persona and it destabilizes it to show us the pervasive power of sin. It's a complex argument. So, you know, our listeners are going to go out and get your book. They're going to read it. But right now, briefly, give us a little sense of, you know, what your argument is about the persona in Romans 7.
Yeah, you have done very well to stay with that, because it is a kind of complicated argument I got into there. I began with a problem in my reading. A biblical scholar whom I greatly respect by the name of Paul Meyer wrote a piece in the 90s on the worm at the core of the apple, which is a great article. And he persuaded me, and I think many people, that what is central to Romans 7 is not the I, but sin, right? And when we start our discussion of Romans 7 by saying, I need to find out who the I is, we're working at a disadvantage all the way through. The problem here is really sin. What has sin done even to the law, to the good and righteous and holy law of God? How can Paul say the law is good and holy and righteous and yet say, I am under sin if I try to follow the law, right? So the issue is not so much the identity of the I. For me, this was a brilliant, really, I was about to say life-changing. It's not quite that, but it certainly was an exegesis-changing piece to read. Nonetheless, everyone I know who reads that passage has a response to it. There's something visceral, right? And I kept using this in class, and I kept having people say, but why do I still feel this, right? And I put those things together, and in part, the psalm text helps me, but just a little bit. I'm going to set that aside for now. I think as many as scholars have held for 100 years, the I is largely stylistic. It's not an autobiographical I. It's the... it's one, you know, we would have said in formal English 50, 75 years ago.
That's one.
Yeah, yeah. It's, well, in 1 Corinthians 13, when Paul talks about love, most people don't think that's an autobiographical passage. They don't respond
taken,
to
point
it.
Point taken.
Right? Okay. But I do think that when you use I language, there is something of a, whether it's intentional or not, I don't know, but I functions as a kind of invitation. If I say, here's a good example, I loved the movie The Odyssey, you know, that is an invitation.
No, don't let Emily Wilson hear that.
Yeah, that is an invitation, right? You either stand with it or you don't, or... for those who know famous Christian hymns, well, and I just totally blanked on what I wanted to say. The I of a number of late 19th century hymns is an I who walks and talks with Jesus. You know,
right?
You are
right.
when you sing a hymn. When you stand in church and share in the Apostles' Creed, when the congregation says, I believe in God the Father Almighty, that is a witness, but it also functions as a kind of invitation, question, if you will, for the bystander, is that where I am? And I think Paul is, well, I don't know whether he's doing it intentionally or not, you know, but I think in this passage, the I functions to draw the hearer, the reader in. Back in chapter one, he's talked about those people over there who did terrible things, right? In chapter five, it's all in Adam, all are in sin, and here it is. And this is the last time, really, he talks about sin. It's I, right?
Okay.
Even the I that, with the psalmist, loves the law and wants to follow the law of God. Even that one, right? So it brings the reader to a kind of crisis.
I like that. Now, there's another term that I do want to turn back to, and it is in Romans 6, and every English translation of Romans 6 that I've read has Paul call the faithful not to be, quote, instruments, end quote, of evil in verse 13. But you drew my attention to that word, and in your interlinear translations in this book, you translate that word as weapon, so I went back to the Greek. Like I said, the best biblical studies get me back into the original languages. And the noun there is hopla. So my question is that the same root of hoplite, you know, the fearsome, you know, heavily armored infantry trooper? And if so, I mean, as far as you're aware, why has the tradition been to take the weapons out of Romans 6 and talk about instruments, which honestly sounds a lot more sanitary?
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for previous translators except to say, and now I will speak for them, except to say that, you know, I think there's a certain graphic quality to that expression that probably unsettles people. There is throughout chapters 5 through 8, there's a series of images that are drawn from a conflict. You know, you get this notion of the wages that sin pays. Well, that word is a word that's also used for the wage paid a soldier. Paul talks in chapter 7 about about sin taking an a forme, a ground of operation. You know, there is there is this series of images that is fairly conflictual, and you know, I may make too much of them. I think other people make too little of them, but this is another one. And here it's very specific. Present your body parts, you know, your own limbs as weapons. Notice that it's they are the instrument. And here's where instruments is good, or weapons. They, what are those? Those are objects in the control of another. You're not soldiers in the sense that you... Or you're not in charge of this battle.
Right.
Right. You are under the charge of someone else.
That makes good sense. So, I mean, and this is just, you know, my seminary Greek being rusty. Is that the same root as, you know, hoplite?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I, you know, it's funny because, you know, one of my seminary New Testament professors, you know, Roland Ramseren, you know, always taught us to read Paul as a rhetorician. And so, you know, I mean, when I learned that, you know, Paul used this image of, you know, do not give your members over to be weapons of evil, I thought, man, that's a rhetorically powerful moment. And it just seems like, you know, we should avail ourselves of that when we translate it. So I'm glad that I know that now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Your approach to Israel in Romans really caught my attention, largely because I've never thought very long about the identity of Israel in Romans. So what kinds of things makes Israel's identity fluid in Romans, or is that even a good metaphor? And what sorts of things can we see better if we start with your claim that, quote, Israel is always and only God's creation, end quote?
Well, you know, maybe one of the reasons that I say confusing is that in our current context, we, it's not just us, but, you know, we speak about the reality of Israel as a country, a nation in our world, right? And I think it's very important for us to realize Paul is not talking about a nation by the name of Israel at the present time. And we can't extrapolate from there. It's interesting to me that Paul talks a lot in Romans about Jews, but he uses the word Israel very seldom. And that's true throughout his letters. And a couple things I noticed about that. One is back in chapter 9, at the very beginning of 9 through 11, he talks about the gifts of God to Israel and about what I would take to be God's creation of Israel through offspring for Abraham. Right? That passage is often taken to mean God chooses in Israel Jacob, well, he does, God does Jacob over Esau, and that this tracks with later on with acceptance or rejection of Jesus, right? That people have always been either responsive or unresponsive, either obedient or disobedient. So you get Jacob and you get Esau, and you get some Jews and you get other Jews. But that's exactly, if you read chapter 9 very carefully, that's not what he does. What he, his emphasis throughout is on God's actions for Israel, God's, and I do use the word creation because he talks about God calling, I've lost the language now, calling into being, you know, God calls these people into being. So you get this notion that Israel is always God's creation.
Right.
And he makes no distinctions there, that some are in Israel and others are not. Then you get to chapter 10, and a very strange thing happens. He says that God has tripped Israel, 10:32. Mm-hmm. God put a stumbling stone in the path of Israel. Israel, pursuing the law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. And in chapter 10, he uses the word Israel without any suggestion that there are some Jews who believe Jesus to be the Messiah and others who don't. So what does he mean by Israel there, right? I think if he doesn't mean the whole of Israel, then the thing doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, he knows that there are Jews like him who believe Jesus is the Messiah, and there are others who don't. I think where he goes with that is what you end up with in chapter 11. It's another one of those places where he seems to be trying to drive people to his conclusion by making them see what the problem is. He creates this argument, you know, that would drive you to say God has rejected his people Israel, and then he asks the question, has God rejected his people? And the answer is, of course not.
Right.
Why? I mean, implicitly, I think it's, these are God's people. This is what he made.
Mm-hmm.
There is no possibility of rejection. So you have to ask the question, then what's going on? Mm-hmm. Well, I think the answer he gives is, at the present, Israel is divided. Israel is divided between those who have been called at the moment. He calls them the elect, the ones called, that's all elect means, called into faith, and the ones sure. who've been hardened.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardening is temporary. And it has okay. as its goal the rescue, the evangelism of Gentiles. It makes a mm-hmm. space for Gentiles. And then his final thing is all Israel will be saved because the gifts and the promises that God makes to Israel are without mm-hmm. end.
All right. I'm going to call it a tangential question, but it's one that I like to ask New Testament scholars, because one of the things that happened to me when I did start studying Greek back in seminary is that I noticed that, you know, eudioi always retains that delta in the middle of it. And so, you know, I started translating that not as Jews, but as Judeans, so that I could kind of get the regional in there along with the worship element and the family element and so on and so forth. Is that a defensible translation choice on my part, or should I just call it Jews like everybody else does?
Well, it's certainly defensible. I mean, it's not incorrect. Mm-hmm. It's pretty complicated, and there are very strong opinions about this among New Testament scholars, especially mm-hmm. around issues of how Christians read and understand the eudaioi in mm-hmm. our own texts. I think there are places where eudaios simply could mean just Judean, right? And nothing mm-hmm. more. It certainly doesn't mean people of the Jewish belief. You know, in the ancient world,
right.
This is a people group,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's another problem with using Judean, because you could be a eudaios and never have been in the territory of Judea, right?
Right, that makes sense. So Galileans would still be eudaioi.
Yeah, well, you could live in Alexandria.
Oh, point taken.
And be eudaios, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the problem. And it gets into a whole lot more difficulties. As one scholar put it, Adele Reinhart's, you know, the problem with using Judean is that all of a sudden then there are no Jews in the New Testament. What does that mean? You know, that's okay. That.
Okay.
You're trying to correct for, and rightly so, a lot of anti-Jewish readings of scripture, but in the process, you've created another problem altogether, because guess what? Jesus is a Jew. Paul is a Jew. Most of the characters we meet in the New Testament are Jews, whether they're Judeans or not.
Right. And I guess my analog, and I realize we're kind of going far afield from your book, but we're talking
That's
about
okay.
it. So I want to keep talking
That's okay.
about it. But I guess I can think of someone who grew up in San Francisco as Chinese, even if they've never been to the continent of Asia.
Right. 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 And you could think of somebody who grew up in Alexandria as Jewish, who had never been. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. All right. All right. Let's get back to your book. Let's get back to your book. This is a good book. We should talk about it. Right. I want to open up things for you to comment on nomos in Romans, because in English translations, at least, it's hard for me to keep track of whether nomos is one thing or three things, or if I'm completely losing a sense of what that Greek noun nomos means. So how do the nomos that increases trespass and the nomos that holds captive relate to the spiritual nomos and the nomos of my mind and the nomos of sin and death? And is the word law a good translation for all this? Because at some point, what I think of as law and what Paul seems to be talking about here, I can't tell how they relate to each other anymore. So what is Paul doing with this term nomos, and how does an apocalyptic reading of things help us to make sense of the rhetorical position of nomos in this letter, and also what kind of referent or reference that noun might have? Gigantic question, I realize, but you wrote a very compelling book, so I'm going to ask you gigantic questions.
That's just fine, and I'll see what I can do with it. Sometimes people will translate nomos as principle. I find it as a principle when I'm, I find it in my mind. That is, I find I find that it happens this way. I find that it happens this way, that when my tall husband has left the house, that's when the smoke detector battery goes off and starts chirping, I mean, honestly, I do find that to be a law.
I believe you.
All right. So people sometimes get around it this way, because Paul seems to use the word in so many different ways. My strategy with this has been to track what he says and to look at how it changes over the course of the letter, and sometimes he speaks of nomos, law. I always translate it as law. Sometimes he speaks of it in positive terms, and sometimes in what we would call negative terms. So what's he doing? I think it has to do precisely, you ask about apocalyptic, with this this notion that law is God's own, but law can also be, the power of sin is such that it can make use even of the law, which is a terrifying statement. That's what makes Romans 7 so terrifying.
Right.
Is sin has gotten, not that sin has gotten the whole law, but sin has managed to use the law to enslave me. Right. So when he says things like the nomos of my mind, I think he means the way I'm thinking about it. I don't think that's actually the hardest one, but it's the law. The one that's the most crazy making is at the beginning of chapter 8, the law in verse 2, the law of the spirit. Sorry, the law of the spirit of life in Christ Jesus versus the law of sin and of death. I'm going back here to Paul Meyer's article that I mentioned earlier. I think for Paul the Apostle, there is this reflection on the law. In the hands of sin and death, it can do this. in the hands of the Spirit of life in Christ, it can do that. So these are aspects. It's not aspects of the law, but it's the law under the authority of these varying agents.
Mm-hmm. And I think what might have made it so terrifying, and what continues to make it terrifying, is that, you know, if your liturgy involves the Torah Psalms, then, you know, oh, how I love your law. Your law makes wise. Your law is, you know, perfect. Your law is, you know, within that matrix, within that rhetoric, within that poetic, right? There's very little room for imagining that the law could become a weapon, you know, in the hands of evil, to go back to an earlier conversation, right?
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
You know, I definitely understand that you're saying that this is, you know, a horrifying bit of rhetoric. I mean, do earlier commentators find this as horrifying as you and I do? Or is this something that, you know, people kind of skated past by and large when they commented on St. Paul's letter to the Romans?
Well, people have, you know, argued all sorts of things about the law in Romans. And
yeah,
sometimes
that point taken.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, one way of thinking about it is in relationship to Galatians, and which is so negative with respect to the law. And sometimes what people say is, well, Paul is correcting himself. He's offering something more positive. I think what really happens is that people take one passage and that becomes the thing they read. And then elsewhere,
right,
they think, well, it's just principle.
But
it's, you know, I'm thinking of an example. Let's say we might agree that the speed limit is a good law,
mm-hmm,
right? You shouldn't drive over 30 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour in a school zone, or 15 miles an hour, all right? And it's that law is there for a good reason. It's to protect children. It's to keep you from, or keep me from, doing something that is harmful to children. But there could also be a 25 mile an hour speed limit that we've set up on the edge of town to fool the innocent who's just come passing through this little town on the way to somewhere else. And it's a speed, what we would call a speed trap. It's a way to fill the coffers of the local of the local township, community, county, whatever unit you want to use. So the law can be both good and bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, what I'm talking about there is kind of what Paul is doing. It's not that the law is inherently one or the other of those things, but that it is being used to good or bad ends.
So, I mean, talk to this for a moment. I mean, my sense is that the rhetoric and the poetics of the Psalms really does treat the law as something inherently good, as something that couldn't be captured by evil.
Yes.
So is Paul doing something unprecedented here, as far as your studies tell you, or is Paul doing something that he has inherited from some Second Temple tradition that I'm not aware of?
Well, he certainly is. There is certainly a distance from the Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's not, because for Paul, the law is good. It's not a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what we
but
get
it can
in,
be captured.
Right, right. And I think that's, I'm hard pressed to come up with a place where that would be recognized. But then the difference is, you know, here we have to go back to it, is Christological. Paul is convinced that God has acted in a person by the name of Jesus to bring about the end of human captivity. For Paul, this is the Messiah of God. And okay. once you say that, then you may reevaluate earlier notions. Right?
Okay, that makes sense.
And that is not to say that the law has now become bad, but that it may be that I am... that I am captive to a certain understanding of it. And I do think you get notions, you know, you get it in the prophetic literature, not okay. necessarily an attack on the law, but on human beings who do not respect their obligation to others.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Would there be a strain of Job in there perhaps as well? Because that's not something that I actually thought of when I was writing up these notes. But in our conversation just now, it occurs to me that, you know, in Job, it's Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar who say the things you're supposed to say about God. And then Job is going these crazy directions. But then at the end, you know, Adonai says to Job, go and pray for Eliphaz and make sacrifices for him because what he has spoken is not true. So, I mean, yeah. you know, is that a precedent here, or am I pressing Job unfairly into service?
I don't think so. Okay. I think there are very few places in Paul that, I mean, you might say in big threads, there are places where Paul is defending God. Mm-hmm. 9 through 11 may be one of them, but by and large, I think that's not what he's up to.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I want to turn for our last few minutes here to some of your conversations and some of your engagements with some modern readers of Paul and modern readers of Romans. And I'm going to ask about Bart. So, I mean, when your book turns to Bart, you focus on some attention on the metaphor reflection. When you call Bart's writing on Romans a reflection, what's the difference between that and, you know, perhaps other commentaries? What's the difference between a reflection and other kinds of writing about Romans?
Yeah, well, I mean, you may have caught me in a very sloppy expression there. What what I'm getting at is a phenomenon I have experienced over the years with reading Karl Barth's commentary on Romans, mm-hmm. which is that there are many places where you would be hard-pressed to know what text he's talking about, right? You know, it goes off and you think, what? How did you get here from that? How on right. earth did you, why are you writing this? And yet I have found over time that when I sit with those passages and I read the passage he's commented on the one hand, mm-hmm. and I reread what he said, I start to see how what he has said helps me to understand the passage better.
Okay.
Right? Reflection is probably a very poor way to put that, but there's a sense in which he, because I respect him, I sit and I wonder, where did you get this? What are you seeing? And then I start mm-hmm. to see things in the passage I hadn't noticed before.
Right. Well, let me attempt to make a case for your metaphor, because I actually liked your metaphor of reflection, because,
okay.
you know, what I took from it is that when you read Bart on Romans, what you are seeing is an image of Bart and what Bart notices in Paul, but that, you know, in seeing those things and in attending to those things, there are things that, you know, more conventional commentaries on Paul won't pay attention to in the same way that Bart does. So it opens up possibilities for further commentary that might not have emerged from a more conventional commentary. I mean, yeah. is that kind of what you're driving at with reflection, or what?
Yeah,
am I doing reflection now?
No, I think we're saying very similar things.
Okay. Okay.
And it's often been dismissed by biblical scholars. I mean, it's ironic. It's been dismissed by biblical scholars on the grounds that it's not historical and it doesn't really reveal text and so forth. And there's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. Ironically, I think theologians who think very highly of Bart and of the commentary also minimize it as a commentary. They treat it as a systematic treatise, which it's not. It really is right. deeply, and this is maybe what you're saying, it really is deeply engaged with the text, but mm-hmm. he doesn't show us how it's engaged with the text. So you're always trying to retrace his steps.
Okay, that makes some good sense. That makes some good sense. I want to turn from Barth to other theologians who do commentaries, because I thought this was a very interesting conversation towards the end of your book. Longtime listeners of this show know that Stanley Hauerwas has joined us a couple times to talk about a couple of his books, and neither of those books was his commentary on Matthew. So talk to our listeners a little bit about post-Barth, what's praiseworthy about inviting theologians like Hauerwas to write commentaries on the Bible, and then talk to us about some of those, what you just mentioned, those trends in, you know, theologian-written commentaries that tend to go wrong.
Okay. Well, I think one of the things that's good about that is, or one of the reasons those commentaries have come into being, written by theologians, is their frustration, which I understand, with biblical scholars who don't want to talk about God.
Right.
You know, or who want to downplay the theological content of texts in favor of other issues. And I don't blame them for that at all. I share some of that frustration. And I'm happy for theologians to try their hand at writing their way through texts. I think the problem is, and I'll come back and say that biblical scholars have a parallel problem. The problem occurs when theologians read along, and the next thing you know, they're thinking about a certain kind of ethical problem, or they're thinking about a Christological problem, and the next thing you know, they're writing about that. They're not writing about what the text says. They've sort of gone off, right? An example I will use is from Yaroslav Pelikan's commentary on the Book of Acts. Now, Yaroslav Pelikan was an immensely learned human. Right? He knew a great deal about the development of Christian doctrine. So when he's reading the Book of Acts and he gets to things like, this is an example. I'm making this up. I'm not remembering
sure,
it.
Sure.
I haven't looked at that particular book for a while. But let's say he gets to the selection of the deacons. You know, well, then historically, he's going forward to the role of the deacons and what they've done and blah, blah, blah. Or the notion of the ordination, what ordination means, right? So you get all of these, the text becomes something other than an examination of what Luke has actually written.
That
now, I think biblical scholars, I think we have a similar tendency where we know that people have discussed the following text and they've had these questions about it. You know? So how do you get out of that to ask something that's fresh, right? Because we sort of read with the blinders in place that we've inherited from our predecessors. It's a human problem. There's nothing vile about it.
Sure.
But it does help, I think, to ask, you know, to what extent is this really engaged with the text?
That makes good sense. I'm going to ask a question here, a gigantic question that we can't possibly cover in an hour, and then I'll ask you to talk about it in our closing minutes here. In the book's introduction, you note that this book is a companion volume to a commentary on Romans that you've published. So briefly, what are two or three interesting conversations that emerge if one takes on the chapters in this book, Readings in Romans, alongside your commentary on Romans?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure that I know how to answer it. I think, in a way, this companion could be taken as a series of appendices to the commentary. As I'm working on the commentary, certain questions come up for me. You know, what does Paul mean by Israel? Well, in the commentary is not the best place to take that up at length, but I can write this chapter over here and reflect on that. Or I can become, as you can tell, interested in Barth's work. Well, I don't want the commentary to be about Karl Barth, right? In some cases, what you have, as we've talked about, are the kinds of detailed studies of individual terms that I plug back into the commentary. So they need each other, but I wanted I wanted to be sure that the commentary itself was a readable volume, and that it didn't go off in directions that kept the reader from attention to the primary text.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Gaventa, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Romans, about St. Paul, about translation, about whatever else as we head for the door?
Oh, given the nature of this conversation, I would say that a general thing to, for all of us to think about is a little more than we tend to do in our contemporary age, is words and their work. You know, one of the things that I got from from that strange passage in Romans 3 is this notion that words do harm. And sloppiness and vileness of speech does a lot of harm. On the other hand, words can also be elements of praise, right? Which is where Paul goes with it finally in Romans. So how do we wield our words in the world? How do we pay attention to them in the words of others in ways that are constructive and uplifting rather than detrimental? I think would be one of the things I would want everybody to think about, myself included.
Yeah. Beverly Gaventa, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Readings in Romans from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.